Many have asked us how such cooperation in the civil rights movement and for other social causes came about, and have requested that a story be written. Responding to that request, this is that story.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer and emeritus speech communications professor, Dr. Alan Ward. His new book, Civil Rights Brothers, The Journey of Albert Porter and Alan Ward, published by Award Press in Little Rock, chronicles his friendship and work with civil rights activist Albert Porter.
He said, "Why don't you and I tonight declare ourselves brothers and our families as one? Each of our children can be cousins to the other. We and our wives can be aunts and uncles to each other's children." We shook hands and became a family.
Ward and Porter started out in two different places, far apart, unknown to each other. But the lines moved closer to each other until they came together, and then side by side, next to each other. Arts and Letters, up next. For the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
You've got to give the devil his due. He surely will pay when he comes for you.
Today we'll be talking with Dr. Alan Ward as he recounts his life and work as a civil rights activist and his deep friendship with African-American civil rights leader, Albert Porter.
Forgiveness is there, waiting for you.
In the time and place that Ward's meeting with Porter occurred, the civil rights 60s in the South, people saw it as an unusual friendship.
Just one simple prayer to hear it from you.
Alan Ward, writer, emeritus communications professor, civil rights activist, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
You begin the book with the metaphor of a ring of silver, turquoise, and coral, fashioned by a Native American artist. The ring had a mound representing a mountain with a line on either side of the mountain. The artist told you this was the Native American sign language symbol for friendship.
I was in Arizona at the time, and the idea was that these two lines starting on either side of the mountain with people who didn't know each other, when they came around the mountain and met and then continued on parallel lines, that was friendship. And that became to me a symbol of what Albert and I experienced when we finally met.
Porter's outstanding work brought him to the attention of Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee, where he was offered a job as business manager in 1958. Would you tell us the story of how you two from different sides of the mountain came together?
Oh, about 2 weeks into the semester, we were at a faculty gathering on campus, and I was living on campus in a faculty apartment. And so I thought it was time to find out who was leading the movement, and I asked one of my co-workers, "Who's in charge of the movement? Who's the advisor?" And they pointed across the room and said, "Albert Porter." Well, he was there already. He had been there a year or so. I walked across the room. We had our first conversation other than just saying hello. And I explained what I wanted to help in any way I could be of help. But he would have to indicate what that way was because he knew what I could do or not do to assist. And he looked at his watch and said, "We can start in about 5 minutes." Of all the interesting circumstances, he had been asked by the wives of some of the faculty at a private white school in town to come over after dark so he wouldn't be seen to talk to them about the movement and what was really going on. And he had asked one of the women on our faculty, an African-American faculty member, to go with him. And so he said, "You come along too. Maybe you can be a buffer." And so 5 minutes later, we were in the car headed over, and that's when we started working together that night.
He won't turn away, leave you at the station. Just one simple prayer, you'll know what to do.
And The ladies met us at the door of the home where we were meeting and saying, please, hurry in, hurry in, hurry in. Did anyone follow you? Because if anyone followed you, this house could be bombed.
In my gloomy room.
Well, no one apparently had. We got inside. One woman blurted out, not, I think, intending that this be the opening, but she said, why are you people doing this to our town?
Been waiting to hear, to give you salvation.
And Albert very gently and kindly, understanding people's individual frustrations, said, we're doing it for the sake of our children, for all of our children, that they can get to know each other and have the same opportunities all the children can.
Now when I'm afraid and the storm is upon me, just one simple prayer will calm the sea. Same on the earth as it is in heaven. I pray to the Lord to deliver me.
Another kind of activity that occupied some of the evenings was the literacy training. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to help adults who had never received the opportunity to learn to read and write.
In the midst of all the other things going on, most people outside those who were working with it did not know that Martin Luther King, along with his other goals, wanted to be sure that some generations of African Americans who had never learned to read and write because of the school system or their lack of schooling at all were now in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and they could not read or write. And he said, we owe it to them to help. He wanted to be started in every community groups of volunteers who would go out to the homes of these individuals. And so Albert and I helped establish that in our area. Once a week, after work, we would get into one car, a car load, and we would go out into the more rural areas, and one person would be dropped off at each farmhouse, and we would work with our person. The driver of the car would go to his farmhouse, and then when he had finished, would turn around and come back and pick each of us up. So I was dropped off at my location and working with a gentleman in his 70s whose goal was to be able to read a newspaper. He wanted that so much. And so every night we worked through letters and sounds and syllables and small words and larger words. And finally the evening came when he leaned across the table in his farmhouse, the family members seated around with us. And he said, opening the paper, listen to this, and he read for the first time in his life aloud a paragraph from the paper. And then he reached across the table, taking one of my hands in each of his, and said, you are the first person of your background to ever be in this home with whom I have ever had a conversation in my 70-some years. And we both sat there and looked at each other and with tears rolling down both of our faces.
The local Jackson NAACP chapter met in a church sanctuary regularly to assess progress and formulate subsequent plans. You invited out-of-town guest speakers to offer advice and encouragement. Megger Evers came and met with your group.
He was staying at Albert's home overnight. So after we had had the meeting in a local church, we came back. Albert lived on campus, as I did. We went to Albert's home, and Medgar Evers wanted to talk further. And so we talked for hours into the middle of the night in one of those unplanned-for moments, which was just a treasure. And in the midst of what he was talking about, he said very calmly, you know, I will probably be killed. There's nothing that can save me. because I won't leave what I'm doing or go to another place. That would be untrue to the civil rights movement. But there's nothing that can protect me, because even law enforcement is often on working with the segregationists. And he said, I just want it to be that people will not be discouraged by my death, because there will be martyrdoms, and that should reinforce us to go forward until there are no more martyrdoms or segregation.
He was gunned down in his driveway.
Right, soon after that, Albert and I stayed up that evening talking about our memories of that conversation with him. And Albert said, you know, it doesn't seem that the current generation is the one that's going to make the big changes. They'll be doing things that can change the laws so people can come together, but the big change is going to be in the next generation.
Kept you both going?
We were always looking for what Albert, one of his favorite phrases, the teaching moment, when someone seeing something new or hearing something new would have to deal with this in their own thinking. And that process could change them and their children and their friends. And so it was just the eagerness to see the world change for the better.
Just one simple prayer, he'll know what to do.
We're talking with Alan Ward about his book, Civil Rights Brothers, The Journey of Albert Porter and Alan Ward. In the spring of 1964, Albert was walking with the students carrying signs on a downtown Jackson sidewalk that urged stores to hire black clerks. The African-American population was refraining from purchasing anything at these stores until hiring changes were made.
Even when it became, as in the earlier days in Jackson, Tennessee, when the students were peacefully demonstrating for selective buying, and that was to buy at stores that would actually hire African Americans, because most of the stores wouldn't. And at such a demonstration, when he was marching and the students were marching, just carrying very simple placards indicating, let's purchase where we can work. To have a man come out of the crowd that was hissing and booing the walkers with a pistol that put to Albert's head and said, I'm going to blow your, and I won't repeat the rest of the words that came after that, I'm going to blow your blankety-blank brains out. And again, Albert was so dedicated to the movement, to the change, for the children, for the students. He just kept walking as he had been, carrying the placard saying, selective buying. So unexpected was that response of continuing on, and Albert just said to him in a very normal voice, he said, you must do what you think is best, and I will continue doing what I think is best. And the man had, it looked almost a seizure. His arms were going up wild. He was waving the gun around. He ran off into the crowd screaming. So what kept both of us doing the things, even when we were on late rural roads at night with a car, seeing both of us in the front seat together, one driving, one in the passenger seat, starting to smash into the back of our car to try to force us off the road, and certain oblivion. But the whole idea was someone had to go through this, just like Medgar Evers said. There'll be martyrs, but the cause is greater than the individual. That was the concept that kept us going, and then the reinforcement from each other. Because even on that night, with someone trying to push us off the road and not knowing what was going to happen next, and there being no place to go for safety or help, we agreed, if this is the end, we're both in good company.
When you come down to my side of town, hard times hit you, they spin you around. I see you on my side of town.
Your travels took you to France, Egypt, Budapest, China, Japan, India, together?
I mean, we had people tell us, you can't, you're Americans, obviously, but you can't be together because in America you're not permitted to talk to each other.
I'll be the face you never wanted in your crowd.
That was a statement on the Great Wall of China. And there were, yes, there were these questions everywhere. What is really going on? What's the nature of it? And then how could the two of you possibly know each other?
On my side of town. On my side of town. It's a short fall down, a long crawl up, you see.
They would turn into conversations because one question would lead to another. And then we would feel free in there and in other places to ask about their concerns. What about the Australian Aboriginals? What is the relationship there? What's being done about that?
On my side of town. On my side of town.
We found, without exception, everywhere we went, the pattern was the same. It might not be legal segregation by law, but by practice of individuals and organizations, we found the pattern existed everywhere. Racial, ethnic, caste, class, economics, gender, all sorts of different things, but the pattern was the same. Putting people in a category and reacting to the category rather than the individual human being.
When apartheid was being challenged in South Africa, your communication conference was invited to hold its meeting there with the understanding that the diversity of your organization would be welcomed without restriction. When the conference organizers asked that the participants be permitted to see the black as well as white sections of the city, the officials agreed.
This was before apartheid had ended. But we wanted to be sure that going there would not in any way support apartheid, and that we would be permitted to have people in our international organization of whatever background be there and be comfortable and be given rooms, and that we would be able to have native South Africans invited to speak to some of the sessions. And the government indicated, yes, all that could be agreed to. And so we went. One of the people who came in as a speaker from one of the townships was intrigued that Albert was there and that he and I were together from the United States, so he had questions. And then he said to Albert, I bet you would be interested in seeing what the township is really like because they'll never take you there. And he said, well, yes, I would be happy to do that, but, and then pointing to me, he said, but he would need to go too. And he said, oh, that would not, that's not permitted. Then he said, well, no, if we do it after dark and he may have to hide in the back of the car, we can do it. And so we both taken out there, met his family, had a similar experience with his father, who reached across the table and took both my hands and said, "You're the first person of your background ever to be in this house and with whom I've ever had a conversation," as opposed to just exchanges of orders and things. And then, under cover of darkness, late that night, we went back to the hotel. And the next morning, one of the local officials of the conference called me in and said, "We found out what happened and where you went. Don't you realize this could have caused an international incident of major proportions?" Well, sometimes when things start out one way, other things come from it.
Back in Little Rock, you followed the news daily of the changing conditions in South Africa, and then came an unexpected contact.
Fast forward a little bit, and apartheid is on the verge of ending. In South Africa, they're not sure whether there's going to be a bloodbath or what's going to take place, and they're trying to find the peaceful means of doing it. Albert and I are here in Little Rock and are contacted by the South African government saying, "We are concerned about the peaceful transition. We understand that the two of you have found a peaceful way of coexisting. We want to send an official delegation to Little Rock to speak with you in depth, so you can help us make that transition." They sent their delegation to Little Rock. We met with them in depth and were so happy that we could have a small part in that connection with South Africa.
Seems to me that much of your and Albert's work concerns planting seeds in people's mind, defying easy generalizations and categorizations, and listening.
Mm-hmm. It was a real treat when finally an international organization, the International Listening Association, developed to do research, because a lot of research wasn't being done before that in listening. And so we were both members of that and would go to its meetings. We even presented papers there on listening in interracial discussion group. And so that was a real, real, real treat.
Your efforts for civil rights had many casualties. Some were almost invisible.
Local white Southerners who sided with integration found that they were set upon by their so-called friends and even family at times, and they were the invisible casualties. Many people just didn't know that they existed because they evaporated, in a sense, from the social scene. And in one instance, for example, a person had a business, and when he was speaking up in his community, in his church, for integration, he was asked never to come to the church again because Jesus Christ had forbidden integration, he was told. His wife was put out of every organization that she, social organization she belonged to. His children, almost on a daily basis, were beaten up and bloodied at school with the permission of the faculty and administration of those schools. People boycotted his business and he went bankrupt. And he was a ghost. He had African-American acquaintances, but they couldn't do much for him. He needed a job, but no one would hire him because of his stand. And it was just to watch the downgrade. We kept in touch with him. Even after moving here, we followed him up because he had been in Tennessee. And talking to the African Americans who would see him and sometimes just take him food because he didn't have enough to buy groceries. And they used the word, they said, "He's a ghost. He's become a ghost of his former self. He's not going to survive. But he's not one of those written up, because he wasn't one of the visual movers and doers. But it was people like him that made such a difference in the quiet ways that he could.
So Albert was a dear friend.
Mm-hmm.
When did he pass away?
He passed away last year.
What was his service like?
It was a celebration of his life that had been... People came to talk about all of those wonderful groups that he worked with, the life changes that he had helped people make, the kindness he had shown people experiencing difficulties, but how it was always equally based. He loved children, and he always wanted to see children and old people well treated. He would go out of his way to do things for, but these were children and old people of all backgrounds, indiscriminately. He and I shared the concept that there's only one race, the human race, and just many wonderful variations.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org.
Leave us a comment there and post your own civil rights story. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you to the Damsels in Distress who supplied the instrumental music. Thank you to Gil Franklin for the guitar stylings and songs.
Oh, my set of ten.
Oh, my set of ten. Thank you to the St. Mark Baptist Church praise team for the hymns.
On the mountain, over the hills, and everywhere.
And Nathan Vanderver for recording them.
Thank you to Wythe Walker on keyboards and Ron Boswell on tenor sax. Thank you to the incomparable Chris Hickey, whose talent helps us to produce these shows.
Generous support for this program was provided by the UALR Foundation.
On behalf of the College of Arts, Letters, and Sciences, thank you to Alan Ward and his continued and unceasing dedication to human rights. I'm J. Bradley Minnick for Arts and Letters, leaving you with the words of Medgar Evers, "Freedom has never been free."